Good evening. Welcome to Women's League Seminary Synagogue here at the Jewish Theological Seminary. My name is David Kramer. I am the director of the library here at JTS. We at the library, as a center of Jewish books and research, have had the privilege and joy over the course of the most recent number of years to sponsor book talks on the part mostly of our faculty members, but on occasion outside authors as well. Those of you who have been to the book talks before will know that these are generally very wonderful occasions, but they tend to be smaller than this. I think it's fair to say that this is the largest gathering to hear words about the Ein Yaakov that has ever occurred at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And I suspect that it has little to do with the Ein Yaakov as such, and a great deal to do with the author of the book on the Ein Yaakov, whose words we're going to hear this evening. That is to say, Marjorie Lehman. So first of all, Marjorie, let me thank you for agreeing to speak as part of the library's book talk series. I had the privilege, actually, we in the Department of Talmud and Rabbinics set up a system a number of years ago whereby senior members of the faculty took some responsibility for helping to mentor less senior members of the faculty along in writing books and working toward promotion and things of that sort. So by the color of my beard, you can tell that I counted as a senior member of the faculty, and I began to work with Marjorie as she was working through in creating this book. Now, if you read the acknowledgments at the beginning of the book, you will find that there are many, many people who are thanked there, and I don't want to take any more credit than I deserve, because some of you who were actually here had a great deal to do with the production of this work. All I can say is that I had the privilege of meeting with Marjorie regularly over the course of the period that she was producing this, reading it carefully in what we still anachronistically call manuscript, seeing the book as it came to fruition, and it's here for all of us to read, to see, and after the talk tonight, also to purchase, if you like. So it's just wonderful, and it's great to be able to be here and celebrate with you, because this is as much a celebration as it is a book talk. Just a couple of words about the book and then about the schedule. The book is really quite extraordinary. Marjorie takes a work which I think it's fair to say in our day is relatively little known, even amongst relatively educated Jews beyond the name. Right? I mean, the name is amongst educated Jews well known, but if you were to actually ask someone, okay, smarty, what is this Ein Yaakov? It's fair to say that they wouldn't be able to put together the first accurate sentence, that is to say, until they read what's here. And Marjorie has taken this relatively known book and put the book and its author, the composition and its author, in a historical context, shown the way it developed in response to particular historical circumstances, to particular ideologies that were current at the time, in relationship to other kinds of Jewish cultural production at the time. The variety of perspectives that she takes are just fantastic and provide us with the opportunity really to learn about Ibn Habib and about the Ein Yaakov in depth. And I might add that equally as wonderful to all the things that I just mentioned is the fact that parts of the commentary, the Ein Yaakov, on the Agadic portions of parts of the Talmud are abundantly quoted and illuminated by the author. And so if you've never studied the Ein Yaakov, and I know that that included me before I began reading this manuscript, Marjorie also serves as a teacher of this work. She's well known as a superb teacher around here. you have the opportunity, meaning in the book you've got the opportunity to see one of our superb teachers teaching about the work that she knows better than any around here and which she clearly loves deeply. And so you're here to hear her and not me, but I had to say appropriate words. The only thing I want to add to what I've said so far is that Marjorie will present and teach. We will have an opportunity to ask questions, make comments. And after all of that is finished, you are invited into what is called the Alpern Lobby. If you don't know where the Alpern Lobby is, then just follow people who do. That's, you know, the only way to get there from here. So look for people who look like they know where they're going following the talk here. And there will be a dessert reception there, which is sponsored by Marjorie and her husband, Ari, and family, I assume. And there will be copies of the book available for purchase. And I'm going to bet that the author would be happy to sign them when you purchase them. So Marjorie, please.
Thank you for that introduction, David. And it is true that David had played a large role in helping me to get here. So I'm very pleased to be introduced by you. And I'm very excited to be here at this moment, marking a really important time for me, seeing this project come to an end. But David sort of stole my thunder a little bit, because I'm beginning the same way he began in my talk, which is to tell you about why it is that I was particularly drawn to this collection. And that has to do with the fact that when I would walk around and talk to people about the fact that I was writing on the Ein Yaakov, they would tell me memories of their study of the Ein Yaakov with a parent or a grandparent. But they never could tell me who had anthologized the collection. And they never could situate this collection in its time and place, even recognizing that it really comes out of a Sephardic context, not out of an Ashkenazi context. And so with that, it became clear to me that someone needed to write the history of the origins of this work, if only to restore Ibn Khabib to his rightful place in the history of a collection that became one of the most well-known collections of Talmudic Agadah and one of the most significant contributions to the history of Jewish literature. When I began to work on transforming my dissertation into a book at JTS, ensconced in the daily challenges of teaching here, I also began to see myself through Ibn Khabib's eyes. And I realized that many of the questions that Ibn Khabib had were really my own. How can I teach my students to affect change? After all, how does one change a culture or an ethos? How does one unify fractured communities? How does one educate people to have faith? How does one help people to develop stronger connections to Judaism? And of course, the most salient questions for those of us who spend our time, especially here, teaching Jewish texts. How does one inspire anyone through a text? Whether it's a passage of Tanakh or Talmud or a medieval Spanish poem or a modern Hebrew story, can a text move a person intellectually as well as spiritually just because it moves me? Well, I think about these questions a lot, and I don't have all the answers yet. Ibn Khabib was grappling with many of the same questions at the beginning of the 16th century when he thought about his community. And while I do not claim that his answer should be ours, I enjoyed being witness to his struggle. I reveled in his optimism. And I rejoiced in his interest, not merely in the thinking human being, but in the feeling human being. Ibn Khabib wanted the texts of the Talmud that he included in the Ein Yaakov to touch people emotionally, spiritually, and religiously. The focus of my talk this evening is to examine Ibn Khabib in his desire to change the world in which he lived for the people he lived with. How would his plans for the Talmud bring his people back to faith following the expulsion from Spain? And so, in order to situate us all in time and place, I'll give you a little background about him, Jacob Ibn Khabib. He was born in Zamora, a Spanish city in Castile in the middle of the 15th century. He later assumed a leadership role in the Academy of Salamanca. The expulsion of Spain's Jews in 1492 resulted in his relocation to Lisbon, Portugal. And his confrontation with a decree of forced conversion instituted by the Portuguese monarchy in 1497. By the year 1501, Ibn Khabib had again relocated, and along with many other Iberian Jews, he resettled in the Ottoman city of Salonika, alongside Jews from many different locales who had been expelled from other places in Europe prior to 1492. In Salonika, Ibn Khabib resumed his role as a prominent rabbinic leader and began his work on the Ein Yaakov. He was unable to complete his work before his death. Many don't know this. He's really only responsible for the first half. His son Levi Ibn Khabib produced the second volume of the Ein Yaakov, titled the Beit Yaakov, which begins with Tractate Yevamot of Seder Nashim. And that's why the first half of the collection really doesn't match up with the second half of the collection. His son didn't have the same kind of interest that he did in the work. So what is the Ein Yaakov? The Ein Yaakov is an anthology of Agadic texts drawn from the Talmud. Agadah, defined in the broadest sense of the word, refers not merely to rabbinic stories, but to all non-legal material. Ibn Khabib boldly assumed the literary freedom to break apart already established Talmudic passages where halakha and Agadah were often intimately linked, creating an entirely new collection of Talmudic material. But how did he organize it? What was the first problem that he encountered? What do you know about Agadah in the Bavli and Yerushalmi Talmuds? Indeed, the Agadot are strewn throughout the Talmudim and enveloped within halachic sugyot, or passages. They are not organized according to theme, and to find any Agadic passage on a particular subject requires that you simply remember where it is. So in organizing his collection, Ibn Khabib took upon himself the editorial freedom to remove the Agadic material from its halachic shell while preserving the order of the Agadot as he found them in the Talmud's original chapters and tractates. He gave each ideationally coherent section a number, generating, in a sense, new sugyot. And then he prepared two indexes, one thematic and one that followed the weekly Shabbat Torah reading, in order to overcome, to some extent, the fact that the collection he created was a hodgepodge of Agadot. One Agadic section did not necessarily relate and build on what came before it. However, the collection did resemble the Talmud. Working with the printer, Judah Gedalia, Ibn Khabib added Rashi and Tosafot to the pages of the Agadic text that he anthologized. He then wrote his own new commentary, which he also added to the pages of his collection. This was no small matter for his time, because no one had done it. Few had written running commentaries on the Agadot of the Talmud before him, and none, other than Rashi and Tosafot, had been added to the printed Talmudic page thus far. Indeed, Ibn Khabib's chosen editorial structure, which followed the Talmud, was part of his attempt to critique and reform rabbinic culture of his day. Long before the modern period, Jews had challenged the Talmud's status as Judaism's sole normative text. In fact, in 1516, the Ein Yaakov emerged out of a long-standing debate over the Talmud's canonical status within the curriculum of Jewish learning. Its publication offered a unique alternative text through which to answer the questions that had already been reverberating throughout the Jewish community for centuries. What constitutes Torah study? To be sure, the Talmud's very nature, that is, its complicated dialectical style, its interweaving of the legal and the non-legal material, had led to the production of legal codes so that Jews could readily gain access to legal decisions. However, an increased focus on the study of codes within the curriculum led to a decline in the study of the Talmud, reshaping the curriculum into one that did not necessarily require avid Talmud study and Judaism into a religion represented by another set of canonical texts, such as Hilchot Harif, the 11th century legal code of Isaac Alfasi, or the Mishnah Torah, Maimonides' 12th century legal work. While Maimonides, for example, never doubted the Talmud's significance as a work of Jewish law, he did not envision the Talmud as the central text. He argued that it was a spiritual error to view the Talmud as the only text worthy of study. In fact, in his introduction to the Ein Yaakov, Ibn Habib expresses his discomfort with the study of law codes in particular, which focus only on the legal aspects of the Talmud to the exclusion of the Agadic texts. In Ibn Habib's mind, the loss of focus on Agadah generated by the study of codes was about the loss of the Talmud itself. For him, Agadah was an integral part of what made the Talmud the Talmud. And for him, without a collection of Agadah to match a code like Alfasi's Code of Jewish Law, which is also organized according to the editorial structure of the tractates of the Talmud, the messages contained within the Agadot would be overlooked indefinitely. And these were messages of faith, messages that contained theological perspectives necessary for cultivating the spiritually whole, feeling, and believing Jew. Indeed, until Ibn Habib's Ein Yaakov, no one had attempted to produce a Talmudic, Agadic equivalent to Alfasi's code with the goal of rebalancing Talmudic tradition. No one had directly challenged codificatory endeavors like Alfasi from the perspective of its effect on Agadah in quite the same way as Ibn Habib. It seems that for him, the Talmud and Judaism had been sold short when its Agadic sections were ignored, and this called for a corrective. Ibn Habib would expect that his Ein Yaakov, organized as a Talmud lookalike, would be studied in much the same way as the Talmud itself. Additionally, the ensuing critique of the Talmud, however, involved far more than the production of legal codes. Maimonides, for example, produced a system of thought rooted in Aristotelian philosophy, which he laid out in his philosophical treatise, The Guide for the Perplexed. In the guide, Maimonides charts the path toward an intellectual form of spiritual perfection. In such a system, Aristotelian philosophy, rather than Talmudic discourse, was considered the highest form, the highest expression of the human spirit, and the most significant way of connecting with God. That Maimonides did not hide his preference for the study of philosophy over and above studying Talmud would arouse discomfort among many Jews, including Ibn Habib, for generations. It bothered Ibn Habib that philosophers thought about God outside the lens of the texts of the Talmud and turned to Aristotelian philosophy, and that too called for a corrective. The debate over the centrality of the Talmud also came to include Kabbalists. With the publication of the Zohar near the end of the 13th century, Kabbalists began to pose an array of positions regarding the Talmud that ranged from a desire to supplement Talmudic study with Kabbalah to a need to supplant the Talmud altogether. Ibn Habib's interest in spiritual matters and specifically in faith did not lead him to philosophy or to Kabbalah. Instead, his spiritual concerns led him directly to the Talmud. The image of the Talmud as a work primarily of halakha, not to mention the fact that many felt the need to explore the non-Talmudic disciplines of philosophy and Kabbalah in order to engender a relationship with God, left Ibn Habib with the sense that something had gone awry in the development of the curriculum of Jewish study, especially with respect to theological matters. In his commentary, Ibn Habib explicitly lambasts those who were overly involved in the study of philosophy. And furthermore, Kabbalistic esotericism did not inform his textual analyses. Ibn Habib could not conceive of theology outside of the Talmud, and to him, Jewish theology was rabbinic theology. They were one and the same. And for this reason, the only system that Ibn Habib embraced was that of the Talmud, and it and only it governed the order and content of his interpretations. But to move from the intellectual crisis that he perceived was taking place in rabbinic culture and toward the theological crisis of his day, I'm going to remind you that Ibn Khabib arrived in Salonika at the beginning of the 16th century, following years of dislocation that were set in motion by the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, to face a community questioning its past. They wanted to understand why this enormous wrath had occurred to them. For example, to give you some sense of the times, Isaac Abarbanel, the great biblical exegete, saw the biblical curses invoked upon the Israelites for failing to observe God's commandments as connected to the punishment in Vayikra, "You shall perish among the nations." In his mind, the afflictions and slaughters that occurred to the Jews in exile were God's punishment for transgression. In his torment, Abarbanel went so far as to equate the expulsion from Spain with the Jews' forced exile from Israel into exile in Babylonia. Spain was his Jerusalem. But unlike Abarbanel, Ibn Khabib made no attempt to explain away the travails that he encountered or that his community had faced in his commentary on the Ein Yaakov. Instead, a sense of optimism pervades. Refusing to look backward by specifically naming and describing the traumas of his past, he searches for ways to strengthen the faith of his present community. At the precise time when many were trying to make theological sense of their past experiences, Ibn Khabib took a strong interest in reminding his constituency that the Talmud contained messages of faith. And at a time when history had proven that the survival of Jewish identity did not necessarily depend on the performance of commandments through conversos who began to return to Judaism, but rather on the strength of one's faith, the Ein Yaakov represented a fitting means for cultivating believing Jews. But how is Ibn Khabib going to accomplish this goal? How could a text inspire? How can a text lead one to faith? Indeed, as a Talmudic commentator, the operative question for Ibn Khabib was not, what does this text say, as Rashi had asked, or to concern himself, as Tosafot did, with resolving textual contradictions in the text of the Talmud. For Ibn Khabib, the question was, what does this text say to us? What does this text mean for us? And in what way is it relevant to us? Not surprisingly, Ibn Khabib chose agadot that generated the kinds of questions that he felt were bothering the members of his community. And so, therefore, that question of why me? What had I done to deserve my lot? Or simply put, the issue of reward and punishment caught his interpretive eye. Ibn Khabib began with the following Talmudic text from Brachot 7a, which cast Moses in the role of challenging God on the issue of reward and punishment. You actually have the text. If you didn't get a handout, I mean, there should be enough here. Extras. So on that second page, you have there the text. The text from the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Yossi, Moses requested that God make known to him the ways of God. And acting to fulfill this goal, Moses then asked, Master of the universe, what is the reason why there's a righteous person for whom things are good and a righteous person for whom things are bad? Equally so, there's a wicked person for whom things are good, and there is a wicked person for whom things are bad. In responding to this agadic passage, Ibn Khabib turned to Job, the biblical figure who epitomized the ineffectiveness of God's system of reward and punishment. Indeed, what should Job have done? Was it possible for him to seize control of the system of reward and punishment? Could anyone? Did anyone even understand it? I don't. And so Ibn Khabib wrote the following in his commentary. I'm going to read it in two pieces. I'm going to read the first half, explain part of it, and then the second half. With regard to the righteousness of one's deeds, it is fitting to differentiate between people in accordance with their innate abilities to perform these deeds, and also in accordance with their temperaments. And Job had a great degree of innate potential to do good deeds, and also a fitting temperament. He, of his own accord, was a decent and upright man, and he had the wherewithal to contribute much to the performance of good deeds. And know that God has overlooked for you, Job, some of your iniquity. That is to say, as Ibn Khabib interprets, that the good with which God has favored you has become the cause of your forgetting your sin. For when you see that God has given you riches and honors, you presumed on that basis that you were righteous, not bearing in mind that considering what a favorable temperament and legacy of wealth you were blessed with, you had not performed the amount of good deeds that would have been expected. Job, in Ibn Khabib's opinion, had not lived up to his potential. He had misread the riches that God had bestowed on him initially as a reward for his good deeds. Instead, he needed to strive in a far greater way to achieve religious perfection in God's eyes. Job's mistake was that he focused on God and not upon the fact that he had underestimated himself. He did not understand that he had a greater potential to serve God in a more perfect way. Ibn Khabib wanted to point out through Job that individuals have a degree of control in this system of reward and punishment. But this control is rooted in their ability to understand their inner selves. In an interesting theological twist, Ibn Khabib required that individuals understand themselves and their different personal spiritual potentials. God's ways were hidden, but a person's own behaviors, as well as his own faith, were elements of his religious self that were in his grasp. In a world where it was easy to blame an imperfect God for the tragic circumstances that had forced the Jewish community out of their homes and destroyed their livelihoods, Ibn Khabib attempted to refocus his community's attention on those elements of their religious existence over which they had power. This was the means by which Ibn Khabib hoped to develop a sense of self-sufficiency and security in his readers and in his community. In this way, Ibn Khabib protected the fairness of God's retributive actions. The answer was not, as Rabbi Meir had argued in the Talmud, Brachot 7a, that God simply shows mercy to whomever he wishes. There was actually a pattern of reward and punishment that was not beyond human comprehension. Two individuals could exhibit similar righteous behaviors on the outside and have different experiences with reward and punishment. This was because only one of them had lived up to his innate spiritual potential, the other, like Job, had not. And this spiritual failure made one individual less righteous and less deserving of reward. In the end, this position on reward and punishment also allowed Ibn Khabib to caution his constituency against labeling people as either righteous or wicked based on their external conduct. External behavior, unfortunately, was no measure of whether one had lived up to his spiritual potential or not. Taking this point one step further, Ibn Khabib concluded his comment on Brachot 7a by referring to the rise of political circumstances that could rob individuals of the opportunity to cultivate their innate spiritualities, despite the best of intentions. In keeping with his sense of pragmatism, Ibn Khabib did not ignore the question of how God's retributive system functioned during times of crisis, when individuals could not cultivate their innate spiritual potentials. Although he does not mention the Spanish expulsion, or make reference to forced conversion in his comment, or even cite an example of his own life experience, one can sense that Ibn Khabib is referring to a phenomenon that was familiar to him. Did everyone who did not live up to their spiritual potentials deserve God's punishment? Was Job a fitting parallel for all situations? And now I'll continue in the text, the second half. This is what he writes. This is the end of the comment. And what about the man who desires in his soul to better his understanding and his deeds, and who does not have the preparation so as to fulfill his desire, due to the many external obstacles which confront him and prevent him from acting as he wishes? Because of this, he does not have the means by which he can become a gracious servant. But God knows the true thoughts that people possess, and he prepares a large treasure for the person who is in this challenging situation. And from this treasure, he gives this person a free reward. And God does so with righteousness, justice, graciousness, and mercifulness. According to Ibn Habib, God knows the thoughts that people possess. That is, God knows their internal spiritual potentials as they confront obstacles beyond their control. While it might look to an outsider that such individuals sinned, it was more often the case that they did not have the opportunity to act in accordance with their own spiritual wishes. Ibn Habib suggests that their external actions were no reflection of the level of their true faith. At times, it appeared as though God was handing out free rewards to such individuals, and to some extent that was true, but in reality, such rewards were given to those who possessed a particular internal spiritual potential that pleased God. These were individuals who did what they could under their given circumstances to maintain their commitments to God and to Judaism. For this reason, it was incumbent upon individuals to recognize their innate potentials and in doing so, to develop a strong internal faith that did not involve the questioning of God's role in the universe or God's judgments. If individuals faced barriers that impeded their ability to serve God, Ibn Habib hoped that they would be able to fall back on an internal spiritual strength, believing that it might even earn them reward. To his credit, Ibn Habib focused here on the individual rather than on trying to make sense of reward and punishment from a communal perspective. He never wrestled in his community with the reasons for why God meted out communal punishments, like that of the expulsion of Iberian Jewry. Ibn Habib preferred to think more pragmatically about building a faithful community one person at a time. It is difficult to determine whether Ibn Habib's messages transformed his own community. We just have no evidence to make such determinations. But we do know that Jewish intellectual culture changed forever. The Ein Yaakov became one of the most frequently published Jewish books in the years following Ibn Habib's passing. While there was little interest taken in the writing of running commentaries on Talmudic Agadah prior to the Ein Yaakov, after the first printed edition, numerous individuals wrote commentaries on the Agadot of the Talmud and published them as part of Ibn Habib's Ein Yaakov, especially in Italy, Amsterdam, and the cities of Eastern Europe. Few shared Ibn Habib's theological mission and devotion to uncovering message of faith per se, but many shared his interest in the interpretation of Talmudic Agadah and in studying Agadah as Talmud. As a result, the contours of the collection changed. New introductory essays on Agadah and new commentaries were added to the pages of printed editions. In some cases, Ibn Habib's commentary was left out, displacing him so that someone else could assume the role as the central commentator. Ibn Habib's anthology of Agadot even changed so as to include more Talmudic material, doing more to turn the collection into what Ibn Habib had envisioned, a new Talmud. If you just look at my front page, which is the front page, the cover of my book, thankfully those are two scans that were taken in the library here at JTS. On the left-hand side, that is the first page of the first printed edition, 1516. And what you see there in the bold, I mean, it's kind of hard to see, but in the bold print there, you start with a word that is unfamiliar to you. I mean, well, unfamiliar to you to be the first word of brachot, meaning tractate brachot. Tractate brachot actually begins with the word me'ematai, with a mishnah. And that mishnah is halachic, specifically focusing on Shema. Ibn Habib therefore left it out, and he started from a place which he claimed was a gutic. Many years later, when the collection was reprinted in 1883 by Rom Press in Vilna, they started to add in, it actually happens before that printed edition, but in 1883 you'll open up a collection of the Ein Yaakov and it'll open up Me'ematai, because that's the first Mishnah of anyone knows of the Talmud Bavli. And so as a result, the collection becomes It looks more and more like the Talmud. So it was that Shulamit Soloveitchik Meiselman describes how the people of her father's 19th century Eastern European shtetl took pleasure in a nightly group class studying the tales of Ibn Khabib. Reina Batya, who was the first wife of Naftali Tzvi Judah Berlin, who was the Netziv, and the granddaughter of Chaim Volozhin, pored over the Ein Yaakov as she sat each day focused entirely on her books to the exclusion of household matters. The Baal Shem Tov would predict people's futures simply by assessing the way they read holy books like the Ein Yaakov. And for many children, the Ein Yaakov was an integral part of their elementary education. Remarkably, even the briefest of surveys conveys that Ibn Khabib's work appeared to suit different situations and intentions. Evening synagogue goers did not approach the Ein Yaakov as Reina Batya did in her attempt to live up to her grandfather's ideal of studying Torah for the sake of study, and in her desire to reverse gender expectations regarding study and home life. The Baal Shem Tov had a mystical agenda, using the Ein Yaakov as a means for reading the divine will. And rabbinic teachers viewed the Ein Yaakov as a significant component in the early childhood education of males. So in the 19th century, the work takes on a life of its own, and it continues to do so. Ibn Khabib could not have imagined that his collection would be re-edited and studied in so many different types of settings. He could not have imagined that even the great Hebrew poet Chaim Nachman Bialik would see a need to update the Ein Yaakov, producing yet another type of collection of Talmudic Agadah in the early 20th century called Sefer HaAgadah, sharing Ibn Khabib's belief that Agadah had the power to transform people. Bialik believed that Agadah was a living folklore that could give substance to what it meant to be Jewish, that it was a permanent dwelling for the nation's spirit and soul. Ibn Khabib's enduring legacy is that our ancient texts can speak to us. Therefore, we should not merely study Torah for the sake of it, to be engaged in the act of study, but also for the sake of finding speakable, reachable, and spiritually moving messages. That's what Ibn Khabib tried to do. That's what I'm trying to do here when I teach my students at JTS. My final comment. When I was entering my freshman year at Wellesley College, the summer reading list contained Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. And the message was clear. We need to carve out space, our own rooms, so to speak, in order to be creative and productive women. However, I think my completion of this book on the Ein Yaakov disproves Woolf in the sense that I never could have written it without the people, many of whom are here, who shared my room. And I'd like to thank them all, including the library at JTS, without whom this book could not have been written, its expert staff. So when I bumped into one of the people in the library last week, and she very excitedly said to me, "Your book, it's done." And I said, "Well, I couldn't have done it without the library." And she looked at me and she said, "Well, how do you write a book without a library?" I said, "No, you don't get it. It's that I couldn't have written it without this library." And exactly the kinds of questions that I consistently was able to ask and the way they trained me to study rare books is just extraordinary. So I want to thank the library. I want to thank David Kramer, my mentor. I want to thank also Hector Guzman for this entire event and all its organization. I want to recognize our past chancellor, Ismar Shorsh, who's sitting here, who knows that when I entered JTS, I had a meeting with him in that first week, and I told him, "I'm going to write this book on the Ein Yaakov." Here it is. My colleagues at JTS, all of whom are here, or many of whom are here, my friends, and of course, my dear, dear family, who weathered the storm. So thank you. And we're going to take questions. Few minutes to, if you want to ask me some questions on the Ein Yaakov, I'm happy to answer. So don't be shy. Otherwise, I'll have to ask myself questions.
You did such a complete job.
I know, I did such a complete job. No one has a question. So, Uta. By the way, Uta is a descendant of Ibn Khabib.
right?
Yes, it's true. So,
I wanted to ask you whether or not you think that there is any kind of influence or connection between Isabel al Makaba and who wrote the Menorah HaMaor or Isaac Abuah.
Oh, okay. So Ibn Khabib actually mentions in his introduction Menorat HaMaor. It is 100 years or so. There's two of them. Right. So he mentions, and it's unclear exactly which ones he's referring to, but he does mention Menorat HaMaor, and those are collections that are actually arranged thematically. And he indicates that while he is following in the footsteps of their focus on Agadah, he's rejecting their commitment to thematic organization. He doesn't want to create a thematic work. So he actually specifically states in his introduction that he's departing. But again, he doesn't specifically say which Menorat HaMaor, so it's hard to know. But I note in my book, I talk about both. He did. He did. But he don't. I mean, this is something that you can look at in the book as well. I do. I spend a lot of time talking about the theological agenda of the era right before him and their interest theologically in issues of faith and how that influenced him theologically. So I wouldn't say his theology is completely new. In other words, his interest in faith is not new. It's just the way he goes about it is new. So, but certainly it's, you know, it's there if you want to take a look. Go ahead.
I've also read somewhat ironic that people who study Yaakov assiduously avoid the Mamara Brashot Chazal of Abraham ben Arambam that generally appears as the preface. Do you know at what point in time in Google's selection that was?
I don't know exactly which edition it appears for the first time. It doesn't appear in the first printed edition. He has, in other words, because that particular piece was written before Ibn Khabib, Ibn Khabib's 1516. So it's unclear, I mean, it's clear that Ibn Khabib had no interest in including that in his printed edition. There is a point at which, and I can't exactly note when it is, although I'm guessing it's sometime during the 19th century when the Eastern European presses, especially in Vilna, are trying to produce a traditional text of the Ein Yaakov, and they try to gather as many introductory essays as they can on Agadah to create more of a compendium of Agadah under the name Ein Yaakov. And then what happens, interestingly, is that when the 1917, when Glick produces its first English version of the Ein Yaakov, which is only the Agadot, not any commentary, it's just a translation of the Agadot, they include as an introduction that essay, without Ibn Khabib's essay. So why that becomes so central, I really don't know. And that's always been a question for me. But certainly initially, it wasn't something Ibn Khabib. He doesn't even talk about it or refer to it in his introduction. So it's not there. But, yes? Yeah. Oh.
How does Ibn Khabib relate to the collection of Midrashim, which were readily accessible?
Okay, so he almost never, maybe in like one or two cases, will he pull in his collection of Agadah itself anything from Midrash, anything from Midrashic collections. Once in a while in his commentary, he knows them. He'll refer to them. He'll say, well, in Shemot Rabbah, there's this, da-da-da, and he'll pull it into his commentary. But it's important for him not to be creating a collection that coheres around biblical psukim. He's not interested in that being an organizational theme or tactic for him. He's departing from that. And he definitely wants to create a work that's really focused on the Agadot of the Bavli and Yerushalmi, of the Talmud. And I think that comes out of the fact that he's reacting more to the codes, more to Alfasi, more to wanting to parallel Alfasi than anything else. Because that's what's going to, you know, sort of give him that credibility. So Midrash, Agadah, those collections do not play a major role in terms of him deciding to collect stuff from them. But he does refer. I mean, he clearly knows them. So, Judy.
What percentage of the Agadot in the Bavli appears in this Ein Yaakov?
Percentage. I don't think. You mean how much of all of the Agadah? Okay, I would say.
I think you're saying that okay.
He did make choices. So a lot of the what we would consider non-halachic material that appears in the Bavli appears. A lot. I wouldn't be able to give it a percent, but a large swath. He's not leaving out much. I mean, he's really trying to collect as much as he wants. And when things are added in, very often over time what's added in and when the collection starts to change, they tend to be more halachically oriented pieces that help the agadic piece, that sort of contextualize it a little bit more. But I can't give you percentages. By the way, I have to recognize my teacher, my colleague, Professor Judith Hauptmann. She sat on my dissertation committee and just has been a tremendous contributing force throughout my existence in my career as a Jewish studies scholar. So.
In the transmission of Agadah, do we ever see a reworking or rewording of materials?
Okay, so that's a good question. Right, with the rewording. Okay, so firstly, by the way, you know that you do have changes, manuscript. In other words, there are going to be changes in the wording based on girsa problems, meaning, sort of looking at different editions and different editions over time, you'll see that there will be some changes. But in terms of acting like the Riff, because, Riff will add in his own words and he'll insert, or that also of Bialik, too, will do that. He kind of smooths out the language a little bit. Ibn Khamid doesn't do that. He is looking at probably 2, 3, 4 manuscripts of the Bavli, less of the Yerushalmi, he just doesn't have a lot of the Yerushalmi available to him, and he's looking at them, and he's pulling out directly from them, but he is not adding in his own words. That's why he writes a commentary. But that's also part of the greatness of Ibn Khabib, that he departs a little bit from Riff. Riff takes a little more independence there, but Ibn Khabib wants to stick to the Talmud. He wants this to be like the Talmud. I think Riff was trying to, sort of exert much more of a sense of departure from the Talmud.
He selects the version of a Haggadah that looks best out of the manuscripts he has, and he pulls that into
Wait, say that again?
When he finds, does he pull out a selection in its entirety from, like, the best version that he finds from the manuscripts, or does he make a collective?
Okay, it's very hard to tell whether he's really trying to create a best text, because it's very hard to tell exactly which manuscript he was working from. And what I've seen is there are some places where it looks like he's working from this manuscript and some places he's working from that manuscript. And then, of course, we've lost many manuscripts, so it's hard to tell. So I decided, and I made a decision at a certain point after many had wanted to see a book that did just what you're saying, which is really do the manuscript work. And really produce and really show, sort of what manuscript each comes from. And I decided that I didn't want to do that because I wanted to do more of an intellectual history. I wanted to talk about the origins of this man and this collection. And I wanted to situate him intellectually within that culture and not ignore Spain and that whole piece. That's a different, that's definitely a different, a route, so to speak. But certainly people, that's certainly research that needs to be done in a much larger way.
Did you suggest that Bialik's anthology is exclusively based on
I don't think Bialik was only looking at the Ein Yaakov. I think he was trying to create an update of the Ein Yaakov. But I think he was looking at the Bavli, he was looking at other... I don't think that he was just using the Ein Yaakov. I don't. Right. He was looking, he would compare, like he would find an agadic story or whatever, and he would compare, and usually he took the one he thought was the latest version, and he would fix it. But he wasn't only looking at the Ein Yaakov at all. But he wants to sort of claim himself to be in that trajectory, but he's not. No.
When David introduced the talk, he began, in a way, by talking about the obscurity of the Ein Yaakov. But I wasn't picking that up because in your talk, and I'm wondering whether today that his characterization is in fact more accurate, and that your characterization is throughout Jewish history this was a well-known work, and somehow it's fallen out of familiarity. Would you say that's true? And if it is,
it depends on the community. It depends on the community.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it depends who you're talking to. I think around here, David's right that it has fallen somehow by the wayside into a bit of obscurity. I think a lot of it also is its availability in terms of language. It's not been translated, meaning its commentary is not translated, and so it's not easy access. But for certain communities, Ein Yaakov is a key work. It just depends on which community. And many of the people I talk to who've studied it usually remember studying it with a grandparent. So I do think today that's probably the case in modern Jewish culture, that it's sort of fallen by the wayside, unfortunately. I just think he's making an important point to us, which is that we can't overlook certain texts when we study the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, and I think often we do. So, but I think you're right today for the modern Jewish community. I don't think that was the case 100 years ago at all.
In Sephardic communities, was the Ein Yaakov ever part of a formal yeshiva curriculum?
Okay, so we're talking, he's already 15, 16, he's already left Sephard. So we're talking now Ottoman Empire. So now we're questioning whether in terms of the curriculum of the Sephardi yeshivot or academies that were developing post 1516, was this a main component? I don't know the answer. I would need I just haven't found any evidence to indicate to me exactly what their curriculum was and how integrated this was. I will say that when I do look at it, it's clear to me that it wasn't really just for popular. In other words, it wasn't a popular work per se. He wasn't expecting, you know, you do need a certain intellectual background in order to read it. And I do think that he really wanted and was hoping that it was going to be that. That people in an academy were going to study it seriously, just like they would study a Talmud or codes or whatever it was. I think that was his hope, but I don't really know. I don't have evidence. So, okay. I wait before you go. I have a little special treat by three very special students. They are Shira Wallach and Hilary Chorney. I taught both. Shira Wallach's a rabbinical student. Hilary Chorney is a rabbinical and a cantorial student. I taught both of them as year one students in the rabbinical school. Shoshi Rosenbaum, who was a List College student, has a very special place in our family. Part of me writing this book was because Shoshi saved me on many occasions and did homework and helped me with my kids. But they have talents that you will see. They're going to sing Ein Keloheinu with a Ladino refrain in honor of Ibn Chaviv. And I like Ein Keloheinu because I think it reflects something about Ibn Chaviv and his own commitments to faith and God. So you can sing along. And then we'll have dessert and apple pie.
Great. Before we start, we'd just like to acknowledge Dr. Lehman and thank her for constantly being a teacher and mentor to all of us, and we really appreciate that. Please do join in if you know the tune. Even if you don't know the tune, you'll probably learn it by the end, and the best words are yalala or yadada, so please join in with us. Yeah.
Thank you all for coming. Just before you go down to Alpern Lobby, if you'd like information about future book talks sponsored by the library, please make sure we have your emails. Just to add to what Marjorie said so kindly about the library earlier on, I only want to add that we take donations. And last but not least, to add to my recommendation from the introduction, I've just discovered that Marjorie's book, in addition to the other fine qualities I mentioned, also makes a great drum. So, you know, all kinds of reasons to buy it. Please follow people who look like they know where they're going down to Alpern Lobby, which is on the first floor in Mactherin.
Great. Thank you.
That was great, Marjorie. Great talk. Mazel tov.
Good. It's so glad you're here. It's very sweet.